Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Do please be seated. How glorious to hear that great text of St. Paul's, "Rejoice in the Lord always," set on the feast of his conversion. I'm particularly happy that you did that, because we're pursuing this theme of pilgrimage, so I'm not going to be discounting particularly on Paul, although I will mention the text we had this evening. But that note of rejoicing in the Lord is great to hear, and wonderful to have it so beautifully sung for us. As you know, we're looking at the theme this term is to be a pilgrim, and because it's our Lent term, and we see how Christ 40 days in the wilderness was itself a kind of revisiting, a summing up, a recapitulation of the journey through the wilderness of the children of Israel, the 40-year journey. And I talked to you last week, indeed it was all summed up for us in "Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer," wasn't it? That that sense of our own life as coming up, as it were, being called out of slavery, out of restriction and addiction and the constriction of who we might really be, being called to go down into what we fear and perhaps deal with it, down through the waters of the Red Sea, up again, leaving our pursuers behind, beginning that wilderness journey, and eventually the call to a promised land across the Jordan. That's what we looked at last time. And from here on in now, having looked at that essential archetypal pattern, I want to share with you something of the poets and other writers who've taken up that pilgrimage theme in one way or another. And today it falls to Dante, who was born almost exactly 750 years ago. We know he was born from various little astrological hints he leaves in the poem, somewhere in the late spring of 1265. Certainly both Jonah's cry from the depth of Sheol, of hell, "Your waves have gone over me, will you raise me up again," on the one hand, and Paul's glorious phrase from our second reading today, that this light and momentary affliction is not worthy to be compared with the eternal and exceeding weight of glory. Both that sense of what it is to plumb the depths and what it is to see the glory of God as real, substantial, solid joys and lasting pleasures, as another hymn puts it. Both of those are deeply resonant with the story that Dante has to tell in the great Commedia. So, what is the Commedia about? Why might it still be important for us now, 750 years after its writer was born? And why is it part of this series on life as a pilgrim journey? Well, it begins absolutely and decidedly with our journey through life as pilgrims. You probably all, even if you haven't yet had a chance, the glorious chance that Cambridge and its time to read and plumb the depths afford you, if you haven't yet had a chance to go through the whole of the Commedia, you probably are familiar with its famous opening line, "Nel mezzo di cammino di nostra vita," in the midst of the camino, the way of our life. And indeed, of course, the pilgrim way to Santiago is still simply called the Camino. So it's that's the opening line. In the midst of the way of our life. This makes it, you have this still to look forward to. Some people have said it's the ultimate poem of the midlife crisis. Dante has lost his way. He finds himself in a silver oscura, a dark wood. He tries in vain to struggle up a hill where he knows he should be going, where he knows his true home lies. He can see it brightly shining, but things keep getting in the way, and he is pursued by three dreadful shadow beasts, a leopard, a lion, and a wolf. And what he has to learn is that he has to turn around and face and deal with those pursuing demons, not run away from them. He has to learn that in some sense the way down is the way up, as a later mystic, John of the Cross, put it. And in that lostness, he is assisted in the first instance by the sudden appearance, not of some preacher with a collar round his neck, not of some gilded saint full of churchy associations, not somebody dropping a biblical text on him from a great height in the hope that he'll be startled. He's visited, most astonishingly, by the pagan poet that he loves best. Virgil appears. And there's a wonderful moment where Dante fulfills that fantasy we all have, that wouldn't it be great to meet our favourite author, even if that author was long since dead or lived in another age? Wouldn't it be just wonderful to be able to go up to them and say, yes, your books helped me? And that's what Dante does, of course. He rushes up to Virgil and says, mio autore, you're my author, you know, my authority. But then Virgil says, we've got a journey to go. I'm going to accompany you. And then comes this extraordinary narrative of journey. Before I say anything about that, I'm going to try and summarize it very swiftly. One signal thing you need to know about this poem as you read it, thrilling as the story is, it is also an allegory. That the outward and visible is always in this poem a sign of the inward and spiritual. And although outwardly and literally it's the story of a journey through the three realms, as they were imagined and understood in Dante's day, of the afterlife, a journey into the possibilities that might happen to the soul after death and after judgment, a journey down through hell, a journey up through purgatory, and finally a great rising through all the crystalline spheres of paradise to meet God in the Empyrean. That's the outward and visible thing. And sometimes people sit and read it as though it's a big catalogue of dark stuff or good stuff that is going to happen to people kind of randomly after their death. The outward and visible story may be this exciting journey down into darkness, up into light. But actually, as it were, allegorically, what Dante is offering is not so much a story of a journey we may take some time later in the future, but a map right now of the state of the human soul. That in the shape of the journey, in the emblems of what happens, in each of the circles as we go down through hell, in each of the, as it were, virtuous spirals as we ascend up through purgatory, in each of the glorious spheres of heaven, we have outward and visible emblems of what the deepest potentialities are in the human soul. And instead of thinking about what happens to people in hell as kind of a series of horrible, dodgy punishments visited by a wrathful God, which might appear to be the case in the outer narrative, you should see them as vivid images of what we do to ourselves, of what happens in here, of how things are. I mean, just to take one example almost at random, although not entirely at random, since it's about human love and loving, a subject not always very far from people's minds as they're undergraduates in Cambridge, at least if my experience is anything to go by, and as we've got Valentine coming up. There's a famous episode, the two lovers, Paolo and Francesca in the Inferno, whom Dante meets. There's a great wind whirling round. There's dark, almost impossible to see through smoke, dim, and these figures are being whirled past him at great speed. And eventually, they can't stop. They just carried on. And eventually, one of them comes down and speaks to him, and it's Francesca, who is actually one of his relatives. And she tells the tragic story of her adulterous love with Paolo. And Dante hears it, and when he's heard it, he actually falls into a faint, he kind of swoons, because somehow I think it touches his own heart and where he is. But the image of the driving thick smoke, not being able to see clearly, I mean, there's a great later song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and the image of the wind that carries you away, there is, as it were, morally, one of the things Dante is saying is that because these people, as it were, in this particular sphere, chose to abdicate the responsibility of real choice, made false choices in love, and had the excuse of saying, as it were, well, we just got carried away. We didn't see clearly what we were doing. We were swept off our feet. All phrases that might easily spring to one's lips in the midst of a perhaps ill-advised infatuation. But Dante asks us to imagine whether you could really live a fully human and flourishing life if you never made a serious choice, if you were always carried away by emotion, if you didn't, as it were, stand against a sweeping wind sometimes. And he encourages you to think about later on about a love that might give you clarity rather than obscuring and darkening your view of how things are. So it's not that he's down on the glories of love. In fact, we know that his entire journey is inspired by love, and that it's Beatrice, whom he loved, who sent Virgil in the first place to rescue him. So he's very much in favor of love. And of course, in the Purgatorio, we have another circle, not of smoke, but of clear, refining fire, through which he and the other poets dance so that he can be restored to his beloved. And further up in the Paradiso, in the sphere of Venus, where again he celebrates human loves and loving, he has a woman who actually was probably had more of a worse reputation, was probably much more involved in the illicit side of loving than Francesca ever was, a courtesan of Florence called Cunizza, who, having purged her love, all the generosity of her nature shines out now in glory. And she also whirls around in a circle, but it's a circle of light in which she moves truly by love and doesn't, as it were, say, well, I just got carried away. She herself is one who beams love out. So there's just three examples of how the outward and visible thing actually tells you something about the very nature of the way we move and the choices that we make. So Dante, and by the way, if you're interested in the way that works, there's a magical thing that's been going on in Cambridge for a couple of years now, and it's going to go on for another couple of years. It's called the Vertical Dante, and it's about two or three times a term. You can look it up on the web. The Dante scholars here get together and they read cantos from the Commedia, not in the sequence like this, but they look at how something in Inferno is actually redeemed and answered by something in Purgatorio, and how something in Paradiso takes it even further. It's an astonishing exercise in reading. I commend it to you. So, Virgil turns Dante back, and let me just briefly suggest why this journey is so significant for us today. Well, Dante imagines hell, and remember, he's not simply trying to predict what happens to people. He's trying to map the way we are ourselves now. The bad choices, if you like, the restrictive and dark things. He imagines hell as a narrowing pit, getting darker and closer and more like a kind of funnel as it goes down, going right down to the center of the earth. And as he descends through it, there's less and less interaction and communication. It starts with all the conventional fires, but soon the fires chill. And when he gets down to the real pit of hell, what he shows you is not fire, but ice. And the souls ever more distant from one another, and unable to communicate. And finally, at the narrowing center in the very pit of hell, when he comes to describe Satan, this is very different from Milton's Satan that we might be more familiar with. Milton gives us this rather dynamic, heroic figure making great speeches about freedom, and Blake ends up saying that Milton was on the devil's side without knowing it. Dante gives us this hideous figure frozen into the very core and center of the earth, utterly covering the ice, his wings beating to make a chill that freezes everything, constantly consuming others and offering nothing himself. A three-headed monster who has in his hands three archetypal traitors whom he is continually eating. It's an extraordinary vision of evil. Not evil as the dynamic going up, but evil ultimately as the turning in on oneself. The kind of icy ego at the frozen core, converting everything to your use, rather than radiating out a love that might transform it. And when they get there, there's this hideous figure, and that they keep going. This is perhaps, you want to remember one thing from this sermon. They keep going. They don't say, oh, now I'm down in the lowest pit, I'm stuck, I'm staying here. Satan is stuck, but the pilgrim is not stuck. And as they keep going, a remarkable thing happens, which shows a wonderful combination of Dante's scientific understanding and his spiritual insight going together. You must never believe people who tell you that medieval people thought the world was flat and didn't understand about gravity or spheres. Dante is a complete example of how that's not true. He knew the Earth was round, and he knew that the centre of its gravity must be in the centre, and he worked out, therefore, quite properly, that if you went down and down and down and you kept going down, when you got to the zero point, when you got right to the centre, without changing your direction, if you just kept going, suddenly everything would turn upside down. Suddenly you would be climbing. You would be ascending. And that's what happens to the pilgrims. And as they pass the centre, everything flips over. And this hideous, horrible, you know, brooding, satanic figure who's trying to cow everybody suddenly becomes a ridiculous figure with his head in the sand and his hairy legs waving in the air. And they have to climb up past his hairy legs. And then they get up to the surface of the earth. And he realises that would be the Antipodes. And he recognises that there would be different constellations. He even imagines that one of the constellations might take the form of a cross, curiously enough, not having seen the Southern Cross, of course. And then comes another moment of sheer genius in terms of telling us spiritual and psychological truth for us in our pilgrim life. His next realm is purgatory. Now, purgatory is a place where we suffer, just as we might suffer in hell or here. But whereas the vicious circles of hell just make things worse for everybody, in purgatory, it's possible to take the stresses and strains and sufferings and pains of life and make them do you some good and do other people some good. You can suffer to some purpose. Instead of the descending vicious circle, you have, as it were, a virtuous spiral. Yes, as so often in life, you seem to be going round in circles and coming back to the same place. But in purgatorio, it's just a little bit higher each time. And here's the genius. He imagines that when Satan fell from heaven and made, as it were, the cone of hell by falling into it and then got stuck in the middle, he imagines all the displaced earth, as it were, from that great pit, rushing through ahead of Satan and forming this conical mountain on the other side of the world. So purgatorio is the positive shape made by the negative space of hell. Now, I have to say, personally, found that image extremely helpful in my life. When I'm feeling, as it were, pits of emptiness and loneliness and nothingness, or I'm just seeing the sheer kind of awfulness of evil, as you see, you know, I'm just in a bad situation, I kind of ask myself, what would the positive shape made out of this negative look like? What would its answer and alternative be? It might still be a place of struggle and suffering, but some good might come out of it. And it seems to me he does that on a grand scale. And then, of course, at the top of that mountain, the last circle of fire in which the last sins are purged away, and the poets dance through the fire, he's returned to paradise. He imagines the Garden of Eden up there. There's still heaven to come. And he has a very interesting little insight there, which I think we may also find helpful in your personal pilgrimage. A lot of critique of Christianity and faith in general, particularly by kind of Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment philosophers, has been along the lines that it is infantile or infantilizing. That, as it were, we take, you know, our crouching fear of the authority of parents and just project them onto a big sky, and then we're all kept, as it were, you know, creeping around because we daren't do things, and, you know, so Kant famously says, dare to know. But actually, that is not what mature Christianity is about. And there's an extraordinary moment when, having dealt with his demons and having purged himself and having reordered his life in love, Virgil, who's got him that far to paradise, says to Dante at the very end of the Purgatorio a really remarkable thing. He says, I crown and mitre thee over thyself. He takes the two images of external authority which were set up in medieval culture, the crown for secular authority, the mitre for spiritual authority. That very externalised authority, which some analysts say are what keep people, as it were, from their full development, because they're always got this external authority figure. And as a result of this pilgrim journey, of the deep internalisation of the fundamental issues of choice and human freedom, Dante at the end is able to take that external pushing authority, the crown and the mitre, and have them, as it were, internally within himself. And from then on, he acts with complete and radical freedom, but has internalized, if you like, a kind of solidity and good order and maturity in himself that allows him to make those decisions. So the external authority is seen as temporary, It's something that will ultimately be internalized in an act of integration and maturity. And this is all in a poem whose temporal setting is 1300. So we must be a bit careful sometimes when we ourselves look back on the Middle Ages and think they didn't know anything about human growth or psychology. Well, we haven't time to take you through the full joys of paradise. But as you ascend, you have constant sense of intercommunication. Just as in hell, people freeze and get away from each other, so in paradise, the way in which people can relate to each other becomes richer and fuller. And at the end, instead of that awful three-headed figure consuming everybody else, he comes to the radiant Trinity, from whom everything flows. And then there is one last brilliant coup de théâtre in this journey. In his imaginary world, or in the world as he thought it was, Earth was in the centre, as you know, and then there were the spheres with the Moon and the Sun and Mars and Venus and all the stars, and you kind of ascending out. So all this time in this journey, we've been thinking of ourselves as we go up paradise, going out from a centre to a far distant sphere, the Empyrean. But when he gets there, Dante does an amazing shift of perspective, which is worthy of the best of quantum mechanics, or at very least a good episode of Doctor Who. Just at that point where he reaches the outermost and furthest from his centre, he has a complete revelation and realises that really he's been travelling from the outer to the inner, that he has come to the heart and centre of all things. And in a moment of brilliance and beauty, he suddenly sees the whole cosmos flowering like a great white rose with all its petals around. And he has come to its inner and secret center. So just as the journey down turned out to be the journey up, so the journey out turns out to be a journey in to a center from which he believed and from which I believe you and I all blossom. Because the love of God wills that we should enjoy, in the phrase of another poet, the million-petaled flower of being here. Amen.